I stated that we were going in the right direction, and referring to Dole's speech in San Diego, said, "With all respect, we do not need to build a bridge to the past. We need to build a bridge to the future. Let us resolve to build that bridge to the 21st century." The bridge to the 21st century became the theme of the campaign and the next 4 years. On Tuesday, November 5th, the election went as many predicted. There was a record low turnout, and I won 49-41%. The electoral vote was 379-159, as I lost three states I had carried in 1992, Montana, Colorado, and Georgia, and won two new ones, Arizona and Florida, for a net gain of 9 electoral votes. Because the election had not been in doubt for several weeks, it was easy to miss its significance. After the 1994 elections, I had been ridiculed as an irrelevant figure destined for defeat in 1996. In the early stages of the budget fight, with the government shutdown looming, it had been far from clear that people would support my stance against the Republicans. Now I was the first Democratic president to be elected to a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. 3 days before my second inauguration, I awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Bob Dole, noting that from his service in World War II, in which he was badly wounded, coming to the aid of a fallen comrade, through all the ups and downs of his political career, Dole had turned adversity to advantage and pain to public service. Though we'd been opponents and disagreed on many issues, I liked Dole. He could be mean and tough in a fight, but he lacked the fanaticism and hunger for personal destruction that characterized so many of the hard-right Republicans who now dominated his party in Washington. On the day after the inauguration, as a result of an investigation going back several years, the House of Representatives voted to reprimand Speaker Gingrich and fine him $300,000 for several violations of House ethics rules arising out of the use of tax-exempt funds for political purposes, which had been given by his supporters to allegedly charitable organizations, and also for several untruthful responses to congressional investigators about his activities. The counsel for the House Ethics Committee said that Gingrich and his political supporters had violated the tax laws, and that there was evidence that the Speaker had intentionally misled the committee about it. When I was asked about the affair, I could have urged the Justice Department or the U.S. Attorney to investigate the charges of tax evasion and false statements to Congress. Instead, I said the House should handle it, and then we should get back to the people's business. 2 years later, when the shoe was on the other foot, Gingrich and Tom DeLay would not be so charitable. There were some interesting developments in Whitewater World in February. On the 17th, Kenneth Starr announced that he would leave his post on August 1st to become dean of the Pepperdine University Law School in Southern California. He had obviously decided that Whitewater was a dry hole, and this was a graceful way out, but he received heavy criticism for his decision. The press said it looked bad because his Pepperdine position had been funded by Richard Mellon Scaife, whose funding of the Arkansas Project was not yet public knowledge, but who was widely recognized as an extreme right-winger with an animus toward me. I thought this objection was flimsy. Starr was already earning lots of money representing political opponents of my administration while serving as independent counsel. He would, in fact, reduce his conflicts of interest by going to Pepperdine. What really rocked Starr was all the heat he got from the Republican right, and from three or four reporters and columnists who were deeply vested in finding something we'd done wrong, or at least in continuing the torment. They knew that if Starr quit, it was a tacit admission that there was no there there. After they beat him up for 4 days, Starr announced he would stay on. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. On the last day of April, Hillary and I made public Chelsea's decision to attend Stanford in the fall. In her typically methodical way, Chelsea had also visited Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, and Wellesley, and had been to several of them twice to get a feel for the academic and social life of each institution. Given her excellent grades and test scores, she'd been accepted by all of them, and Hillary had hoped she would stay closer to home. I'd always suspected Chelsea would like to get far away from Washington. I just wanted her to go to a school where she would learn a lot, make good friends, and enjoy herself. But her mother and I were going to miss her badly. Having Chelsea at home in our first 4 years in the White House, going to her school and ballet events, and getting to know her friends and their parents had been a joy, repeatedly reminding us, no matter what else was going on, of what a blessing our daughter was. Economic growth in the first quarter of 1997 was reported to be 5.6%, which pushed the estimated deficit down to $75 billion. About a quarter of what it was when I took office. On May 2nd, I announced that at long last I had reached a balanced budget agreement with Speaker Gingrich and Senator Lott, and the congressional negotiators for both parties. Senator Tom Daschle also announced his support for the agreement. Dick Gephardt did not, but I was hoping he would come around once he had a chance to review it. The deal was much easier to make this time because economic growth had brought unemployment below 5% for the first time since 1973, boosting payrolls, profits, and tax revenues. We got all our education and health money. The tax cut was about 10% of the size of the Reagan cut in 81. The Medicare savings were manageable. The middle class tax cuts were in. The capital gains tax rate would be reduced from 28 to 20%. And everyone agreed the budget would be balanced by 2002, and probably before then if the economy kept growing. My guys had done a great job. At the end of July, we had a big celebration on the South Lawn with all the members of Congress and the administration who'd worked on the budget. The atmosphere was euphoric, and the speeches were warm, generous, and bipartisan, although I did go out of my way to thank the Democrats, especially Ted Kennedy, Jay Rockefeller, and Hillary, for the Children's Health Insurance Plan. CHIP provided health care to millions of children in the largest expansion of health insurance since Medicaid was enacted in 1965. Because the deficit had already been reduced by more than 80% from its $290 billion high in 1993, this budget agreement was basically a progressive budget, with middle-class tax cuts I supported and the Republicans' capital gains tax cut. In addition to the health, education, and tax cut provisions, it raised the cigarette tax 15 cents a pack to help pay for children's health insurance, restored $12 billion in disability and health benefits to legal immigrants, doubled the number of empowerment zones, and gave us the money to continue cleaning up the environment. With all the sweetness and light at the White House that day, it was hard to remember that we'd been at each other's throats for more than 2 years. I didn't know how long the good feelings would last, but I'd worked hard to keep things more civil during the stressful negotiations. A few weeks earlier, Trent Lott, who was miffed about having lost a minor legislative battle at the White House, had called me a spoiled brat on one of the Sunday morning talk shows. A few days after Lott's remarks, I called and told him I knew what had happened and not to give it a second thought. After a hard week, he had awakened on Sunday morning feeling bad and wishing he had never agreed to do the TV interview. He was tired and irritable, and when the interviewer goaded him about me, he took the bait. Lott laughed and said, "That's exactly what happened," and the matter was behind us. Most people who work hard under a lot of pressure occasionally say things they wish they hadn't. I certainly had. Usually, I didn't even read what the Republicans were saying about me, and if a harsh comment came to my attention, I tried to ignore it. People hire presidents to act for them. Getting agitated about personal slights interferes with that. I'm glad I called Trent Lott and wish I'd made more calls like it in similar situations. I didn't feel the same sense of detachment toward Ken Starr's continuing efforts to coerce people into making false charges against Hillary and me and to prosecute those who refused to lie for him. Susan McDougal was being held in prison for contempt because of her refusal to answer Starr's questions before a grand jury. After a brief period in an Arkansas County jail to which she was led in handcuffs, leg manacles, and a waist chain, Susan was transferred to a federal facility, where she was kept apart from the other prisoners in a medical unit for a few months. She was then taken to a Los Angeles jail to answer charges there that she had embezzled funds from a former employer. When newly discovered documentary evidence shredded the prosecution's case, she was acquitted. Meanwhile, she was forced to spend 23 hours a day in a windowless cell block usually inhabited by convicted murderers. She was also forced to wear a red dress, normally worn only by murderers and child molesters. After a few months of that, she was put in a plexiglass cell in the middle of a jail pod. She couldn't talk to other inmates, watch television, or even hear outside sounds. On the prison bus to her court appearances, she was put in a separate cage otherwise reserved for dangerous criminals. Her Hannibal Lecter-like confinement finally came to an end on July 30th, after the American Civil Liberties Union filed a suit alleging that McDougal was being held in barbaric conditions at Starr's request in an attempt to coerce her to testify. On September the 18th, Hillary and I took Chelsea to Stanford. We wanted her new life to be as normal as possible and had worked with the Secret Service to make sure she would be assigned young agents who would dress informally and be as unobtrusive as they could be. Stanford had agreed to bar media access to her on campus. We enjoyed the welcoming ceremonies and the visits with the other parents, after which we took Chelsea to her dorm room and helped her move in. Chelsea was happy and excited. Hillary and I were a little sad and anxious. Hillary tried to deal with it by scurrying around and helping Chelsea organize things, even lining her drawers with contact paper. I had carried her luggage upstairs to her room, then fixed her bunk bed. After that, I just stared out the window, as her mother got on Chelsea's nerves with all the fixing up.